This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Hello and welcome to Enlightened Empaths, your community for the spiritually awakened, where we discuss, explore, and connect with fellow empaths, healers, intuitives, and seekers. Hello, empaths. We hope you're having a great week. We've got kind of a heavy topic to discuss with you for the next 2 weeks that we're going to be with you. But Denise and I think it's a really, really important one. We had Dr. Bradley Nelson on talking about the emotion code, which was such an important reminder about how the body and the emotions and the mind are all connected. And then we had Dr. David Clark on talking about the physical effects that result from having trapped emotions as well. And goodness, Denise, the response we got from listeners was overwhelming, wasn't it?
It really was. Those were both two really poignant episodes. And I think with everything going on in our own lives personally, and you and I have chatted about this as far as individuals on the planet, but also as part of the global family, this is a great time to be doing this kind of work and saying enough is enough.
Yeah, it really is. And so what we're going to be talking with you all about is the inner child, how to heal the inner child, how to recognize if you have inner child work to do, and some steps and exercises you can do to really start befriending and getting to know the inner child within you who probably has a lot to say. Do you want to talk about what the inner child means? What do we even mean when we say that?
Right. Because I think a lot of times we hear that word and it becomes almost a buzzword, or have you done your inner child work? And it can get glossed over a bit because it's so overused in some ways. And really what we're talking about is this is a way, when you start to do this inner child work, it's a way to address the needs that may not have been met as children and to heal any attachment wounds that we've developed. You know, our inner child represents ourselves at multiple points in our childhood. It's a representation of our natural enthusiasm and curiosity that we experienced as children. You know, and why even look into this? Why not just, oh, it happened, it's behind us, move forward? But you can even go back to Jung's work where he stated, you know, our inner child can drive many of our emotions in our daily life, especially when we're unaware of it.
Exactly. And I think that's the key, is that so often we're unaware of it. And suddenly, you know, someone might say something to you and you don't even realize that it's triggering you because it sounds just like something your mom or dad would say to you when you were young. And so you have to really recognize some of the wounds that we've carried from childhood into our adulthood and how they really are framing and shaping so many of our thought processes, our decisions, our actions, and the way we respond to things life is giving to us. So I think it's crucial work. I think it's something we all need to do. But, you know, I've said this before on the show. I've always been the talker in my family. I've always been the one to say, Hey, let's talk about that big elephant in the room everyone's tiptoeing around. It's always pissed me off when people won't talk about stuff. I remember as a kid when my dad, well, you know, he would, my dad was, he's a, he was a recovering alcoholic before he passed for years, but growing up, he was a binge drinker. So there'd be months where he didn't drink at all. And then there'd be months where he drank all the time. And no one in my family talked about it. And I was always the one to go, hello, can we talk about this?
Mm-hmm.
And then my mom would say, oh, your father works so hard, honey, like be nice to him. He's doing his best. He's had a stressful month. And we were never allowed to talk about it. And when he went to rehab when I was 14, they made us go as a family as well, which was incredibly helpful. And, you know, the mantra, one of the mantras of AA or Al-Anon as well is you're only as sick as your secrets. And I remember hearing that and going, thank you. Because it is so important to talk about all of that.
It is. And as empaths, as sensitive people, we sucked all that up like a sponge. And was it, or is our empathy based on our environment or what happened or what didn't happen? Are we wired that way? We've had this conversation in so many different directions over the years. But some of the things that we may not even recognize as maladaptive coping mechanisms can revert back to this unresolved inner child work.
Yes. Yeah, I think it can all go back to that.
I think it's important to bring up, I know it's important. I really feel strongly about this, that this isn't a comparative study. This is very much based on you and what you went through. And one thing that you would see as incredibly horrific, someone else may not even register on their scale of being an issue. So it doesn't matter. If you went through it and it left a scar, that's all that matters.
Yes, that's a really important point. It's how you felt about it and how you feel about it now. And the key is just not minimizing it, but also not awfulizing it, just facing it head on. Squarely and honestly and looking at it. And it's work. It, you know, this is why we're doing this in two parts, because this is a big, big issue. It's a big topic and it takes a lot of effort and work and time. It's a process. It's not an event. It's not a one and done. And I think that's really important to keep in mind as well.
And it's never too late. It is never, you can't say I'm too old. What's the point now? We've shared this a lot of times as well, is when we do this level of work, it sends healing back as well as forward. And I truly believe that many of us have chosen in this lifetime to be the person to come in and do the work to help heal family lines or patterns that may have occurred throughout. Oh, well, we've always done that in this family, or that's the way we were parented, or that's what, it doesn't have to be that way.
No. I think part of what this conscious awakening is all about, that we're all witnessing and experiencing and living in, is about waking up to this and realizing that we're here to break some of these generational patterns and chains.
Yes. And I think it's important as well. It's not always about discontent and shame and fear and all that stuff. The inner child can also be free-spirited and excited and thinking back to times when you were genuinely excited and giddy about something, when you were really happy. That can be as important a part. And I think when you get the other stuff out of the way, or you deal with it, or you look in the mirror and you face it, then you're able to revive that childlike wonder again.
Yeah. I agree. And that is part of some of the exercises we'll talk about in part two, is in reclaiming that inner child, is remembering the fun and the wonder and the joy and the ability to live in the present moment that we had as a child. But, you know, something I'm really, really passionate about, Denise, is there shouldn't be any shame in talking about all of this.
Right.
I get a lot of emails from people thanking me for talking about my issues with my mom. And I appreciate every single listener who reaches out and emails me that, because I get it. I used to be like that too. I used to feel like I had to protect my family, or I don't know. I guess make everything look perfect and right and wonderful and happy and cozy. But I started to realize, I think in my 20s, definitely in my 30s, that my parents aren't a reflection of me any more than I'm a reflection of them. We are individual people who cohabitated for 18 years of my life. And I think when you start to look at it from that perspective, it gives you permission to talk about some of the pain you might have experienced in your childhood.
If you're at a place where you may still be very enmeshed with difficult family relationships, even if you find a therapist or you do the work on your own or you find a group of people, you can still shift things. And it doesn't have to, you don't have to hold yourself back, because I think we were conditioned, many of us, with it, that goes into, I'm going to use the word abuse in a very generic way. If you've been in a situation that limited how you were able to express yourself, that's the way I'm using it, then there is that fear of, oh, well, we can't tell anybody. Keep it a secret. No one needs to know. Don't air your family business. I think that was ingrained for many, many, many people that are listening right now.
Yeah, I do too. But there is something so healing when you can talk about it, when you can share your story, when
yes.
you can, you know, really and truly, and I don't even mean on a podcast in front of listeners. I mean in a journal or to a friend or a therapist or to your pet. I don't care who you tell it to, but I do think it's really important to give voice to the emotions and feelings and thoughts that you're having. That's how we understand who we are and why we're here. But you know, what I think is at the heart of that need to protect the core family is this codependence.
Yes.
You know, to research for this show, I read Homecoming by John Bradshaw. Fantastic book. Completely recommend it for anyone interested in this topic. And he says that codependence is at the heart of the wounded adult child. And he defines codependence as a disease characterized by the loss of identity. To be codependent is to be out of touch with one's own feelings, needs, and desires. And he says it's fostered in unhealthy family systems. For example, everyone in an alcoholic family becomes codependent on the alcoholic's drinking. Because the drinking is so life-threatening to each family member, they adapt to becoming chronically alert and hypervigilant. Adaptation to stress was intended by nature to be a temporary state. It was never intended to be chronic. So over time, a person living with the chronic stress of alcoholic behavior, for example, loses touch with his or her own internal cues, his own feelings, needs, and desires. And he says, Bradshaw says, that eventually a codependent child loses the ability to generate self-esteem from within.
And it also is reflective of repetitive patterns in friendships, in relationships, in work situations, where you make it okay for everyone else, often at your own expense.
Yeah, exactly.
Deep, deep conditioning.
Very, very much so. And so I think if you can separate that codependence and work on that, it will give you permission to share stories and examples and memories from your childhood if and when you feel compelled to do so.
Yeah, and a classic, wonderful resource and book is Codependent No More by Melody Beattie. Mm-hmm. And there is, that's just the benchmark. And it is based a lot on 12-step kind of work. But if you do feel like that's something you'd like to explore, it really is, it's eye-opening.
Yeah, it definitely is. And it's a great start for learning to set boundaries in Homecoming. And I think in her book as well, there's a lot of talk about different kinds of boundaries, right? Like there's physical boundaries, emotional boundaries. It's not just, you know, you can do this, you can't do this. Boundaries is a very big in-depth topic, but it is about recognizing who you are, what you want, what's going to help you to heal now. And my favorite question to ask is, who are you protecting? By not sharing your story, who are you protecting? Are they worth protecting? And what are you protecting? Who has a perfect family, Denise?
No one I've met yet.
Me too. So what is this illusion we're all trying to hold up, that everything's perfect and come beyond the gates of my white picket fence? Like, what is that?
I want to add one more thing with the codependence. I think it's important to note that it doesn't always revolve around substances or alcohol or food, or it can manifest from a lot of different ways that you can be taught or learn to be codependent. It's not necessarily related to a substance.
No, that's a fantastic point. Yeah. Something I think is important when we talk about healing the inner child within us is not necessarily forgiving your parents, because I think that comes later. I don't think when we're talking about doing inner or healing work, I do not think we start with forgiveness. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think you have to like really nurture yourself, take care of yourself, and before you can even begin to do the outside work.
I do too. And I think you've got to allow yourself to feel the feelings, and those feelings are going to include anger and sadness. And how can you feel that if you're too focused on forgiving?
That's a good point.
And so I think you've got to start with your own sacred feelings first. Something that helped me a lot with healing my inner child was looking at the generational patterns that my parents had gone through in their own childhoods, right? Don't you think that's important to look at, well, how was my mom raised? How was my dad raised? Why did they think it was okay to do this or that? Or why did they feel they didn't need to do this or that? When you look at the way they were raised, it's very, very helpful. One of the things I did, oh gosh, when Facebook started, was I reached out to some of my cousins and asked for stories. I reached out to some uncles and asked for stories, because you're going to get different stories from different sides of the family. And I think that can be really, really instructive as well.
That's a good point as well. I think when you start to get to that place where you've released blame, or you've released when you start to make peace with what happened so that you can heal, that's a good sign.
It is a good sign. And it's going to take time. One of the things I never understood is if you were raised in a difficult childhood and you are cognizant of the pain that childhood caused you, why would you continue that when you become a parent? Does that ever, like, that's always bothered me. Whenever you look at any parent who's not doing a super great job, you're like, why would you continue that? Well, in Bradshaw's book, he explains that. He explains how you can look at your own complicated parent through the eyes of their childhood. He says, we tend to think that all people who have a wounded inner child are nice, quiet, and long-suffering. But in fact, the wounded inner child is responsible for much of the violence and cruelty in the world. He uses Hitler as an example. He says he was chronically beaten in his childhood. He was humiliated and toxically shamed by his sadistic father. And he reenacted the most extreme form of that cruelty on millions of people. So yeah, that's an extreme example. But he goes on to say that offender behavior, which is the major source of human destruction, is the result of childhood violence and the suffering and unresolved grief of that abuse. So that's important, the unresolved grief. He says the once powerless wounded child can often become the offender adult. He says these events that they experience are so terrifying to the child that the child can't remain in their own self during the abuse. So in order to survive the pain, the child loses all sense of identity and identifies instead with the offender. And so as they grow up, because they've identified with the offender's behavior, they see that as the only way to be powerful and safe. And that's why they continue the offending behavior.
Oh,
I never really thought of it that way.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about how many, I worked with a lot of children over the years in my professional life that were either in foster care or taken from homes because of severe abuse. And they always, always wanted to go home. They always wanted to go back to that family because that was their normal. Those were their people. And I want to just add that this is an incredibly heavy topic. And I think for some people, it wasn't constant. It was interspersed with times of happiness or joy or fun. And that can be equally as confusing when it wasn't a constant horrific childhood, but just pockets of it, because those pockets are still going to leave a residual impact on your inner child.
That's more confusing, don't you think? I've always said, if someone were consistently a jerk, you would easily leave that situation, walk away from that childhood, whatever it is. But if someone is like, you know, what is my sister calls it, asshole tendencies. Like if someone is, you know, really, really nice and warm and generous and loving for a couple of months, and then boom, something happens, and then they're back to be. I think that's how most abuse happens, right? It's not consistently bad. That's what keeps them confused. It keeps that. What's the new word? Gaslighting.
Oh yes, yes.
Part of gaslighting.
That's what I was thinking about when you were speaking as well, as gaslighting. If you grew up with that level of dysfunction and needing to be on red alert, and that mixed message of I love you and now I don't, that's the perfect breeding ground for gaslighting situations later in life and having them feel normal. Oh, this is what people do when they love you.
Yes, exactly. And I think, as Jung says, until you claim that knowledge, that that's how you look at the world, you're going to make those decisions from a subconscious place. You're not going to make it consciously. I remember when I was dating this guy in college, and I broke up with him, and I could never really understand why I broke up with him. And my friends were asking me, like, why'd you break up with him? He's such a great guy. And I remember saying, well, we never fought. There was just no passion. Like, because I saw my parents fighting, or I saw my mom fighting with me, I thought that meant passion and love. And I didn't, because I wasn't working on myself back then and I didn't understand it on a conscious level, that made perfect sense to me.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah. And then you look back as from the healed inner child and you're like, girl, what, you know, come on. But you can't, I really think it's important to separate as much as you can, forgive yourself and separate yourself from any blame or judgment. Because until you face all of this and heal it, you're just going to react from what you know.
You and I have talked about this. We've talked with a lot of people over the years about this, that we both know, and we've done it ourselves, made conscious choices about certain things our children would never experience growing up, because we did want to break that cycle. And I think that that's really important as well. If you're sitting here listening to this and you're saying, well, I don't have any inner child work, I think most of us do.
I think so too. I mean, I hope there's someone listening who doesn't. That would be amazing. And I'd like to talk to your parents, you know. But I do agree that most of us have some type of inner child work. And I think it comes and presents itself in different ways at different stages of our life.
And it's a spectrum, like everything else.
It is. I worked so hard. It does. I worked so hard to heal my issues with my mom in my 20s. I went to therapy. My sister and I went to a therapist together, which was really, really helpful. And I felt very proud of myself. Like, look at me, I healed it. And then I became a mom. And being a mother brings up all that again. And I had to face it again through the eyes of a mother.
Yes.
And so it's something I want to stress. I know you do too, Denise. It's something Bradshaw stresses over and over in his book, Homecoming, that this healing work is a process.
Right. And it can revisit. You'll think, oh, I've done that work. I got my gold star. I don't have to revisit. And then 5 years, 10 years later, it will come in again. And you'll be like, oh, why is that coming back into my life now? Why am I needing to revisit that? It doesn't mean you didn't do the work. It just means that there's a deeper layer that needs to be released.
Exactly. Like an onion.
Yes. So if you're wondering, well, how will I even know if I have any inner work? One big indicator is a feeling highly, highly reactive to stuff. You can often notice, you know, if you're wounded in your child in your daily life, if you find yourself being really highly reactive to certain situations, suddenly feeling very detached or irritated, that's our adult self trying to manage or control the outside that's making us feel uncomfortable on the inside. And we're not just talking that someone cuts you off at traffic and you shoot them the bird out the window and shout obscenities. Not that any of us would ever do that. But it can just be when something that shouldn't elicit such a highly reactive response, pay attention to that.
Yeah, that's a good one. Or what about the opposite? What if something happens that should elicit a response and you feel numb to it?
Oh, good point.
I think that's another indication as well.
Have you ever had it where there's a situation where you know you should say something and you can't physically make yourself say the words? It's almost that that to me is inner child work. If someone is berating or they're being negative or they're saying something that I don't agree with, and there's a part of me that might hesitate to respond because it's triggering that old stuff of don't say anything. You don't want that barrage of anger coming at you.
Yep, totally. I think I've said before in the show, I used to get a sore throat once a year. And I knew it was throat chakra stuff because I was hesitant to speak my truth. And since I've been very passionate about speaking my truth, honestly and authentically, knock wood, I haven't gotten any sore throats. So I think that is really, really important to look at how you communicate and how you don't communicate or how your physical body responds. Gosh, when I used to stand up for myself, my whole voice would shake and tremble.
I think I still have that from time to time.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes that can still happen, that reaction we have of like, oh, you know, am I safe? Am I right to say this? What will happen? All of that can be very, very triggering. Are there other signs we should look out for?
There are. And this one, I don't even like to say this one out loud because it's that overvaluing independence. And I had to visit, I am fiercely independent. To a fault, stubbornly, stupidly independent. Anyone that knows me personally is probably smiling at that because I can make an ass out of myself by being so damn stubborn and independent. But I think it is, you know, that I don't need anyone. I'll figure it out for myself. If you have a hard time asking for help, if you have a hard time accepting help, I think that can be a big, big, big indicator that there's some inner child stuff going on. For me, it is.
I think it can indicate that you were raised with inconsistent caregivers. And so you had to learn, I can rely on me and I'm not going to let myself down.
Do you also think, and this is me maybe looking for some kind of solace for myself in this, that some of us just come fiercely independent. And I'm looking at my own two children that came onto the planet. Genetically, they are full 100% brothers. They are completely different human beings. So they have the same makeup. They had the same environment. They had the same issues. And yes, the individual's nature, nurture, we get all of that. But one of them is as fiercely independent as I am. And we have similar astrological signs. And so I think that can be a factor as well.
I do too. And I think birth order can be a factor in that.
Yes. So I'm glad that we brought this up because I think sometimes we can say, inner child work, but it might just be other factors as well. So these are all behaviors or feelings or circumstances that might be indicators that there's some inner child work that needs to stop. The big one, though, I think, is destructive coping behaviors. And this can come through too much of anything, too much alcohol, substances, shopping, cheating, gambling, food, procrastination, pick your poison kind of a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Let me read a quote from Bradshaw's book about that. Okay, so he talks a lot about addiction in that book. He defines addiction as a pathological relationship to any form of mood alteration that has life-damaging consequences. So in addition to drug, alcohol, and food addictions, he talks about gambling, shopping, and sex addictions. But then he writes about cognitive addictions, which he says is a powerful way to avoid feelings. He says thinking can be a way to avoid feelings, and it can become an addiction. Have you ever thought about thinking as an addiction, Denise?
No, but I'm thinking about it now.
Me too. He said, one way adult children avoid their legitimate suffering is by staying in their heads. This involves obsessing about things, analyzing, discussing, reading, and spending lots of energy and trying to figure things out. And then he talks about a story about a room with two doors. He says each door has a sign on it. One sign says heaven, and the other door has a sign that says lecture on heaven. All the codependent adult children are lined up in front of the door that says lecture on heaven. Children, he says, have a great need to figure things out because their parents were unpredictable adult children themselves. Sometimes they parented you as adults. Sometimes they parented you as wounded and selfish children. What resulted was confusion and unpredictability. He says growing up like this is akin to arriving at a movie theater in the middle of a movie and never understanding the plot. He says staying in one's head is an ego defense. By obsessing on things, one does not have to feel. To feel anything is to tap into the immense reservoir of frozen feelings that are bound by your wounded child's toxic shame.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. I always thought my thinking was my superpower, but apparently not.
Well, and you and I both love, we both love to look stuff up, figure it out, learn about new things, constantly reading, constantly digging around, trying to find out why things are the way they are. And I do think that's part of just having a really curious mind and not being judgy pie, but being intelligent. You want to learn more. You want to grow. You want to evolve. You want to, but I can see where it would also be a huge yes, I'm looking in the mirror with this because that's the way I overthink the shit out of things.
Yeah, me too. Me too. It makes me feel safe. Like if I can think about and analyze every possible aspect of, before I make the decision, I feel better about it.
Right. And I will even do that with, if I hear a funny noise in my car, and I will Google it, I will look at YouTube videos, I will figure it out so that when I go to talk to someone about getting it fixed, I have a base of knowledge so that I'm prepared.
Yes.
And I think that's
that too, because you don't want to be taken advantage of.
Right. And I always looked at that as, well, that's common sense, so that you at least have some idea and you're not going to be, but maybe that is connected with not feeling safe with what the response someone was giving you in the past.
Maybe it is. We'll have to think about it. Okay, but wait, it doesn't stop there. He says, while thinking can be an addiction, so can feeling too much.
Oh.
Yeah. He talks about being a rageaholic and says that rage helps the adult child overcome feelings of pain and shame. And then he talks about the fear-aholic. These are the ones who make everything catastrophic or awful and drive themselves and others crazy with their panicky fears and worries. There are also the sad addicts who tend to nurture their wounded inner child and cling to their grief. The one addict he hates the most is the joy addict. He said, these are the good boys and girls who are forced to smile and be cheery. It's as if the smile got frozen on their faces. They never see anything bad, but they also never see anything that's real or true.
Boy.
Yeah, it makes you think about our show we did a while back on toxic positivity, right?
Right. And this is really good that we're digging a little deeper with this, because I think a lot of times people might think that inner child work is always about poor emotional or mental health situations. You know, and the guests that we've had on recently have talked about the mind-body connection and how we'll store that in our physical body. And it can be you know, connected with physical illness as well. But those things of depression or feeling unmotivated or wanting more and more time alone or with friends, you know, not wanting to have physical intimacy with people or wanting too much physical intimacy with people, having a difficulty with sleep, weight loss or weight gain, not feeling as focused or productive at work, or increased anxiety in different areas of life. So those seem to be a lot of moods and issues and emotional health situations for many, many of the people that consider themselves empaths, that high sensitivity.
Yes, which we have said is, I think people are born empathic, I do, but I also think it can be developed or expanded upon in a childhood where you had to kind of be tuned in to the different emotions of one or both parents or caretakers. Now, he talks a lot about intimacy. Can I share my notes on that?
Oh, please do.
All right. It's kind of heavy stuff. So he says that adults with a wounded inner child, which he calls adult children, tend to have intimacy issues. He says some are permanently isolated because of their fears of being smothered by another person, whereas others refuse to leave destructive unions due to their terror of being alone. And most will fluctuate between the two extremes. So he talks a lot about this fear of being engulfed or abandoned, which stems from never having a sense of who you are. He says the greatest wound a child can receive is the rejection of the authentic self. When this authentic self is rejected, the wounded child creates a false self. Over time, the adult child believes this false self is who they really are. But it's impossible to be intimate with someone if you have no sense of self. He says the best way to combat this is to set healthy boundaries. As we said at the beginning of the show, he says we have to create and set physical boundaries, emotional boundaries, but also intellectual and spiritual boundaries, because they help us define who we are, what we value, and what we believe in. He says when a child is wounded through neglect or abuse, their boundaries are violated, and this sets the child up for fears of being either abandoned or engulfed. The two most important messages we need to receive as children are that our parents are healthy and able to take care of us. And the second message we need to receive is that we matter. That's really important, don't you think?
I think it's hugely important.
Yeah. However, he points out no parents in a dysfunctional family can give their child what he or she needs all the time because they're too needy themselves. Optimism and trust are the soul of intimacy. We must risk being vulnerable if we want to be intimate. I want to repeat that for people who might need to hear that. We must risk being vulnerable if we want to be intimate. So Bradshaw says that this false self can lead to apathy and depression in adulthood. Depression is the result of the child having to adopt a false self, leaving the true self behind. This abandonment of who you really are can make you feel as though something is consistently missing in your life. He calls it the hole in your soul. And he says when our inner child is wounded, we feel empty and depressed. Life has a sense of unreality about it. We're there, but we're not in it. The emptiness leads to loneliness. Because we are never who we really are, we are never truly present. And even if people admire and hang on to us, we feel alone. So he talks a lot about the false self, but doesn't really go into specifics about it. And so I'm wondering, Denise, do you think that's like the labels that parents often give their kids? Like, you're the smart one, you're the pretty one, you're the athlete, you're the rebel.
I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it. And when we were getting ready for this show, I think we also have to bring into effect the impact of other people in our lives when we were children. So I was thinking about, I went to parochial kindergarten. My sister and brother did as well. And then we went into public school, but that was, you know, we still were part of, you know, parochial education throughout, you know, all those formative years. And my younger brother had this one nun who was just mean as a cobra. She was an angry nun. And we used to joke about her, Sister Katrina. See, even all these years later, I can still picture this woman. I can remember her. If I had had Sister Katrina and not Sister Josephine, who was sweet and loving and kind, that would have been a really deep impact for me, being as sensitive as I was. So I think sometimes things happen in public school, and with, you know, my background in special ed, if you never felt like you were smart enough or that you were challenged or you had learning differences or that you were physically different than other kids, you were larger or smaller or not as fast, all of that stuff can play into this, and it's not always directly related to family of origin.
Yes, that's really a great point to mention, because you're going to encounter bullies and mean teachers and all sorts of stuff when you get into the school time. And yeah, that's also going to wound the inner child as well. It's not just, you know, let's let our parents off the hook for a minute, right?
Right. And immediately the old Catholic in me is feeling like, I'm sure Sister Katrina had some issues growing up, and I feel like I need to apologize for that, or I'm going to be struck. So, but it just the impact that things can seem normal or okay. And then when you step out of that familial unit, you might not even recognize that there was dysfunction until much later in your life.
Well, you know, that's where having a rageaholic parent can help. I had a very mean teacher in the second grade, and she hated that I put smiley faces in my son whenever I drew a sun, you know, over mm-hmm. a tree or a house or whatever.
Yeah.
And she kept telling me to stop doing it. And I don't know why I didn't stop doing it, but I didn't. I kept putting a smiley face in my son. And so the third or fourth time, she locked me in the supply closet. Yeah. And it terrified me. And I came home in tears, and my mom was enraged. And she Ooh. Went down to that school. I don't know what happened. All I know is the next day I was in another class with a lovely teacher, and I was happy the rest of the school year.
The things that teachers used to get away with. Oh my goodness. It's scary.
Oh, I know. Oh, I had one teacher, Miss Hubbard. She had this big, big rock on her desk. This was in the fourth grade. And she said some student went fishing and brought her that rock. And I used to stare at that mother effing rock and be like, who gave her this thing? Because whenever we like laughed or got too loud, she would take that rock in both her hands and bang it on her metal desk again and again and again, yelling at us to shut up. And it scared the crap out of me. Yeah, she was mean too.
Okay, so that kind of proves my point.
Yes, it does. And all of those things will definitely impact us. Now, something else that he talks about I want to mention is trust issues. And something, if you have trust issues, you might have a wounded inner child. Would you agree with that?
Very much so, yes.
Yeah. He says when we're raised with caretakers who aren't trustworthy or are inconsistent, we learn that the world is untrustworthy. And if we can't trust the world, then we can't trust ourselves. So what does this look like as an adult? Well, it can lead to significant control issues. Bradshaw says the need to control everything becomes its own addiction. Oh, look, there's another addiction. Goodness, they're everywhere. He says control madness causes severe relationship problems. There is no way to be intimate with a partner who distrusts you. Intimacy demands that each partner accept the other just the way he or she is. Trust disorders also engender extremes in trusting others. One either gives up all control and trust in a gullible and naive way, clinging to others and over-investing in them, or one will withdraw into isolation and loneliness, building protective walls that allow no one to come in. That reminds me of Dr. Bradley Nelson talking about the heart walls.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. I read a quote from addiction specialist Patrick Carnes, who says, a person who never learned to trust confuses intensity with intimacy, obsession with care, and control with security.
Well, that's a heavy quote. That's a very heavy quote.
I know.
And I think a lot of this can be indicative of repeating patterns in relationships because, you know, unconsciously, whether it's romantic or even just friendships or whatever, we're still repeating those patterns, and it can show up as being avoidant during conflict, being dismissive of someone else's needs or your own needs, gaslighting yourself. And we always talk about being gaslighted or being the recipient of, but I think we can do that to ourselves as well. If you start believing, well, there's really nothing wrong here, or it wasn't that big a deal, or you can convince yourself that it wasn't as much as what it really deserves to be seen as. Being anxious or fearful in relationships, and then trying to please the partner above all else, and maybe having a deep fear of being abandoned or rejected. Those can all be those repeating patterns of, we joke about it and say, oh, same person, different face, but is the real reason that we just need to go revisit that little child who didn't feel safe?
Yeah, I think it is. And one of the things that Bradshaw talks about in Homecoming is, if we don't express all of those emotions, the whole rainbow range of emotions, we will either act out what we experienced as a child, or we will reenact what we experienced as a child. And so he talks about how expressing our emotions helps us in every way on our healing journey. He says expressing fear helps us with discernment. Expressing anger moves us to defend ourselves. The act of crying releases stress and helps us process grief. But when we aren't allowed to express these emotions safely to our caregiver, we can end up either acting them out as adults or reenacting them. So what does that mean? Well, he says if you were raised with a physically abusive dad, for example, you might either become the physically abusive spouse or marry one. But then he talks about acting in, and this is when we punish ourselves the same way our parents did when we were kids. So if you were always to, say, push to clean the house or get good grades, then whenever you perceive a failure like this in your adult life, you will berate yourself. He says unresolved emotion from the past is often turned against the self. Emotional energy that is acted in can cause severe physical problems too, ranging from gastrointestinal disorders and headaches to arthritis, asthma, heart attacks, and cancer. He also says acting in can often result in someone who is accident prone. He says one can inflict punishment on oneself through accidents. Huh. Interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah. But just to think about how you will either act it out or reenact it, or you will act it within. And, you know, something I wasn't really aware of until I married a police officer was how often, you know, we talk about a lot of the examples in Homecoming, he talks about physically abusive men. There are just as many physically abusive women. I can't tell you how many domestic calls my former husband went on where the woman was attacking the husband.
Yes, and it has absolutely nothing to do with who you choose as your partner based on, you know, if you're whatever your identity is and who you choose to share time with in a relationship. It's all the same stuff. And that's why I've said this for years and years. It doesn't matter who you choose. You have to go through the same shit in relationships.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And not as a negative, because there's wonderful things as well, but it doesn't matter if you're bi or straight or curious or whatever. Pick a label. You're still going to have to deal with the emotional connection with another human being.
Yes. I just think from listening to those stories that he would tell when he came home from work, I feel like there's shame around that that's different.
Yes.
When it's a female.
It is. Well, it's the cultural and societal expectations that women... And this, I don't want to go off on a rant about strong women, because I am one and I can rant with the best of them when it comes to this topic. But I was thinking about this. I heard a very negative remark about young men the other day. And as the mother of sons, adult sons, I took it personally because it wasn't directed at me. It was something I was reading. And I thought, so we want to empower young women by denigrating young men, but there's no mutual respect if we don't change that paradigm.
Exactly.
Because there are good men, there are good women, there are good people who identify as whatever they choose to be. We can't pick one over the other if we're really talking about unity and coming together with respect and dignity.
Exactly. We have to lift everyone up if we want to be lifted up.
Yes. And anyway, that's important. The other little factor I'd like to add, it's not little, it's a big, big deal. If you're looking at this and saying, it's too much, I don't want to, I can't, any little steps you take towards facing this stuff, towards releasing it, and some of us might have a longer laundry list than others, but each little thing that you scratch off that list and deal with, it helps you bring back those pieces of yourself that were left behind.
It really does. It really does. Any step, whether it's journaling or just listening to this show or reading some of the books we recommend, every little step in that journey helps you healing and really getting to the core of loving your inner child and yourself and reclaiming your core authentic self, who you are, before everyone told you who you should be.
Oh, I love that. Great way to put it.
Well, I think that false self he talks about in that book is really, really important. And I do think it's more than the labels our parents give us. I also think it's sometimes in dysfunctional families, you're not allowed to feel all your feelings, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you have a rageaholic in the family, they're allowed to be in a bad mood, but you're not allowed to be in a bad mood. You mm-hmm. ever notice that?
Oh, and so yes.
I think that can, all those little things can contribute to this false self where you have to wear this mask. And I think it's important to take, you know, peel that mask away and love yourself in the process so that you can love the authentic self that's revealed when you fully remove that mask.
Oh, that's very, very good point. Was there anything in the book Homecoming about hyper-responsibility being an indicator of
your
child work? Okay.
Yes. He talks about that a lot with codependency.
Okay.
And how a lot of children had to be parents themselves, right? So if one parent abandoned the home or wasn't physically able to take care of the family because of an addiction or depression or what have you, usually that child will have to take on some parenting roles, and that can lead to that hypervigilance that you're talking about in adulthood and that hypersensitivity.
And you love history. So when you look at it in the perspective of, I'm just going to use this one randomly, is child labor laws are a relatively new concept in this country on a historical basis, that it wasn't too many generations ago where children worked. Even when I was a kid, it was normal for kids to go and work. And not saying that's good, bad, or indifferent, it's just a thing. And I think that we're holding, we bring this into a lot of episodes, but I think another aspect of doing this work is that healing that you inherited, that those behaviors you inherited, that you talked about earlier, that it might be the way your parents were parented or what the expectations were, but we're still holding that genetic link. So when you do this inner child work, you're freeing yourself up, but you're sending that healing out. It truly, truly does help everyone, whether they're still here or they're discarnate.
You know, we didn't have a word for teenager until the post-World War II era.
Right.
So childhood is a relatively new concept historically, but so is being a carefree, rebellious teenager. That's really derived in the late 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Well, just think about our mothers' ages. They were roughly about the same age, give or take. And they were children of the Depression or that era or right around. And I can remember my mother saying to me one time, she said, we were grown at 18. You were a full adult. You were expected to go have a family, get a job, move forward. And now that's considered, for many people, a late 20s kind of a behavior rather than a late teens behavior.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. 100%. You should see my daughter with her real job that she's got now as soon as she graduates. And she's like, wait, I have to handle my own healthcare benefits? No. I'm like, honey, you're going to be fine. But yeah, that concept of being married and having a job and a home and all of that at 18 was so normal in the 50s. And to us, it's super foreign now.
Right. Or when you look at what their parents were going through with those little kids during a massive global, you know, the Depression or even, you know, the Roaring 20s, Prohibition, we have all that whole little pocket, or the 40s, World War II. That generation, it was just people did whatever they could to survive and have security and stability in many cases because the finances were so the world was a mess financially. So that's being carried down. So that fear, that anxiety, did that mimic in behaviors or patterns of parenting as well?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
It really, really does. And I don't want to gloss over what you said because it is so important to keep that in mind, that the healing work you do on yourself does go back into the past and it does go into the future. On my other podcast, Psychic Teachers, we did a couple of episodes on near-death experiences. And I read a book about a near-death experience that a doctor had, and it was absolutely fascinating. He was able to send healing energy. In his near-death experience, he learned how energy works and how you can, just by the focus of your thought and the energy coming from your heart, you can send healing energy not only to past generations, but also to past lives.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, it is. It that continuum that we're the ones stuck in the time constraints. The rest of it is just this beautiful energetic pattern that we can dip into at different places along the trail. It's pretty exciting.
It really is. And it's, you know, like we said, it's hard work. It's definitely a big stuff, but it's because it's big stuff and because it's hard, it's crucial. It's so, so important.
Well, I hope that you found a lot of what we've talked about helpful or inspiring or thought-provoking. And we all have childhoods. We all have backgrounds. We all have things that we might want to release or continue to grow and evolve on this path that we're on now. So in our next episode, we're going to give you some techniques and some ways to work through some of this stuff, some different modalities on how to reclaim your inner child and do this healing work that feels so, so important at this time.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you guys so much for tuning in and listening to us. Please remember to hit the like and subscribe button and leave us a review if you enjoy the show, or tell a friend. And please remember, as always, to show up, do great work, and share your light.
Take care.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.